Welcome to the Connect the Dots podcast with Jeffrey Klein, part of the Shareable Podcast Network, and sponsored by AIQ, a snackable newsletter of AI news for busy professionals. Jeffrey engages in conversations with a diverse group of successful people, exploring their stories and the dots they connect along the way. The hope is to inspire your journey and find ways for you to connect your own dots. Here's your host, Jeffrey.
My guest today is Siya Raj Purohit, an education leader, author, and investor. She is on the education team at OpenAI, where she helps manage the growth of ChatGPT and EDU across higher education and K through 12. She was previously an early employee of Udacity and Springboard, an investor at GSV Ventures, and the founding EdTech Workforce category lead for AWS Marketplace. She's the author of Engineering America, a book on the country's job skills gap. Please welcome Siya.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And thank you for being here. I like to start the beginning. So where were you born and what did your parents do for a living?
So I was born in India. We immigrated to the United States when I was six. And my parents, until I was six, basically worked in the Indian government services, IAS officers, which was a very coveted job at that time because it was like focused on India's homeland security. But then India started opening up to the world and they were like, maybe we should pursue MBAs and kind of be part of like the open industry. So they both pursued MBAs. And now that I'm in education, I think a lot about that time period because my mom pursued a distance MBA when we lived in California. My dad was working in tech. My mom had to take care of me and two of my siblings who were both under three at the time. And so her distance MBA program, this is early 2000s, would send her VCR tapes every Monday that she would watch while taking care of like three kids and like complete her assignments. And it's remarkable to think about how far the industry has come in some ways when you think about the education sector. But it's also like still very true how so many people have to balance all these priorities while trying to pursue like new careers and new education pathways. But over time, both my parents pivoted into tech and worked in the sector.
It's interesting. First of all, some of my listeners may not know what a VHS tape is. So that's what we used to watch movies on and recordings. It's before DVDs, like what's a DVD? Before streaming, before Netflix. You know, this is the way you create and consume content. And I love, you know, the fact that being able to pursue educational careers while you're working, to me, is something that I always find remarkable. And distance learning is something that now is kind of, you know, we all kind of do distance learning to a certain degree, anything that we do online, but it was not easy. And I think I had a brother who did his MBA while working, and I'm like, I don't know how you did that. Like, how do you have a full-time job? How do you have a family? How do you do any of those things and focus on it? So it's quite not surprising that you would have parents that were that dedicated to education, and now you're here promoting the education. You're a kid, let's think about when you were still in India. Where in India were you born?
In Rajasthan, but we lived in Bombay until I was six.
So I've only been to the north, so I've done kind of the Golden Triangle. I have to get back to the south at some point. So when you're in India as a kid, say four or five years old, or maybe when you first came to the U.S., did you like, oh, when I grew up, I want to be an X? Did you have any kind of dreams of just, you know, whether it was an astronaut or you know, anything?
I think I first started thinking about career pathways around like maybe 8 or 9. At this point, we were in the Bay Area. All my dad's friends also worked in tech. So we got to see like the launch of all these like great things like Bluetooth and iPhone and all of those remarkable advances. I wanted to be a sound engineer at the time because I loved music. And I thought it'd be so cool to work at like a music company or like a Bose or something like that.
Very cool. So obviously you got interested in tech with due to your family. Did you ever consider anything other than going into something more technical?
So I really thought I would be a good engineer. I loved math and science at the time. But as I guess we'll talk about soon, it didn't pan out the way I thought, especially when I started studying engineering. And that helped me expose to a whole different domain.
Well, at a very young age, you wrote this book, Engineering America. Why did you know, what prompted you to write that book, and how has it influenced kind of your career trajectory?
So basically, I was committed to being an engineer throughout middle and high school, did all of the right types of STEM projects, and get to college studying engineering honors, and suddenly realized that I'm not understanding any of the material that the professors are teaching. As we all know now, like education at universities is often a one-size-fits-all model, and that often doesn't work for STEM education or advanced topics like in electrical and computer engineering, what I was studying at the time. And I started seeing a lot of my friends start dropping out of the program. So you're 18, you're already kind of insecure because you don't know what you're going to become or what you should do. And you see all these friends drop out of these programs. And when you're at a large state school like I was, it's very difficult because the majors project where I cold emailed some famous people to ask for their opinion on why someone should study engineering. This is like later in my freshman year. And surprisingly, these people agreed to meet with me for coffee and told me these incredible stories about how powerful engineering is as a major and a discipline, both in terms of how it helps you think, but what it enables for your like financial mobility as well as for the country's growth. And these people are like a Nobel laureate, a Supreme Court attorney, a professor, author, economist. So it was amazing to get this perspective. Because they could essentially see the job skills gap and the problem America was having with that STEM pipeline before it became mainstream news. So I wrote those, I wrote what I was learning to share with my classmates. And then this became like a whole book. It was 144 pages. So I'm like, okay, might as well put it together. And I got published a couple of days before my 19th birthday. And I started
Wow.
speaking about how we need more students to pursue STEM majors.
Yeah, and I think that's still the case. I remember listening, I think it was Malcolm Gladwell was talking about how a lot of people start off in STEM and then a third of them or maybe in university drop out. He has this theory for why it is, but it's not for lack of interest that people want to do it. But I think it's and from my perspective, my wife and I are big fans of design thinking, designing your life, the Stanford out of Stanford. It's a way of approaching the world in terms of how things what makes things tick. And I think it's I'm not technical, but I still think there's a benefit to thinking like an engineer in the ways that they approach things. So you worked in, you got a lot, you're in this technical background, and then but you also seemed very interested in education. How did those two things, was it because of the skills gap, you're like, we need to educate people? How did you bring those two things together?
So after the book came out, again, a couple of days before my 19th birthday, I started speaking a lot at high schools and colleges about the importance of STEM education and realized that we actually have to make the education more accessible so more people don't drop out of these programs and can actually pursue like more financially rewarding lives that STEM offers. So while I was doing that, these two amazing startups came up, Udacity and Springboard. It was the year of the MOOCs, and they were targeting the same problem. And I realized that's what I wanted to do. Like I wanted to make this education more accessible. So in my career, like I graduated from school, joined Udacity as an early employee, and that's when we built like the Georgia Tech Masters in Computer Science and these other programs that have been like massive contributors to the engineering pipeline. Like the Georgia Tech program now has 15,000 students across the world who are pursuing a full Georgia Tech Masters, but at a fraction of the cost at their own in their own hometowns. So that kind of accessible education was incredible. And I was like, this is what I want to spend the rest of my life doing, like creating these pathways for people. Similar to, I guess, my mom's story, like of who wanted to pursue new careers and pathways, but probably not from the conventional mediums.
Yeah, and so now you're working. It's interesting because you look at engineering, and then I think AI is kind of one of the offshoot evolutions of engineering. At least from software engineering type. But now it's seeped into everything. So your role now is basically to help, as you said, make accessible AI education across the board. What do you find most challenging about that role?
So, just for context, ChatGPT EDU launched in the summer of 2024. This is our product designed for universities and school districts to basically be able to embed AI and to be able to utilize that to let their students, faculty, and staff converse with the knowledge of their campus more deeply. So our aspiration is that campuses like Wharton will have like multiple AI touch points across. So students can have like an orientation GPT or classroom GPTs, and all of these are tutors that'll help students navigate their campus. And so that's what we primarily focus on right now. And it's been phenomenal seeing professors adopt AI. Like there's so many like professors who are rethinking their curriculum, rethinking what to assess for. And a big part of my job is to work with them to kind of define what the future of those disciplines can look like and where AI fits. I also spend a lot of time working with the university leadership to kind of think about their AI vision for their campus, and also with students who drive like the engagement on campuses and are thinking a lot about the future of their own careers with AI.
I've read some stories about and I teach at two universities, so I understand that academics is kind of a unique environment. But I've heard stories of more veteran professors who have said, "Oh, I want to, retire so I don't have to deal with AI." Have you had any pushback from people? Because I think, educators come in all different forms, and there are definitely people who are more the early adopter in, looking for innovations, looking for things. But I'm sure I've had some instances where people are like, no, or wait a second. How do you handle those kind of pushbacks about like, AI is gonna, our students are gonna just cheat with it, or our students are gonna use it as a shortcut, and it's, or we're worried about privacy and that's our, data privacy, security.
So pushback is very common when any new technology comes into play. And I think it's honestly pretty healthy because it helps us question those concerns. It helps us all move forward as an industry. Like I remember when I was at Udacity, we were working with professors who were teaching online for the first time as these massive open online courses took off. And a lot of professors are like, "Hey, I've been teaching for 30 years. I don't need your help teaching in front of a video camera." And we're like, this is not a video camera. This is so much more, right? Like the interaction you can build online with thousands of students is a very different experience. And so basically, it's a similar moment. There is pushback, but I think what's happening right now is that influencers within each of the disciplines who are professors are showcasing what they're doing for the technology and helping destigmatize the use and helping more people just learn how to use it better. I give a lot of credit to Ethan Mollick because I think he just like pushed the sector's thinking forward, being like, this is how AI can be beneficial in education. And then within every discipline, when you look at business education, computer engineering, liberal arts, there are professors who are doing innovative things with AI who are helping everyone else learn in their disciplines.
Yeah, and I'm a huge fan of Ethan Mollick. Partly because I think what he's doing is helping us understand how to apply AI in the right way. And he wrote a couple pieces about education that I reference often, the homework apocalypse and the post-apocalypse situation. I love the fact that, and I was talking to someone about this where if you use AI for a shortcut, you'll do fine throughout the semester, and then the final comes and you don't do well because you haven't learned. And I love Paul Reutzer, who's at the Marketing AI Institute, tells the story of when he was in 11th grade and he was taking a math class and doing word problems. And he's a journalist. That was what he ended up and was always planning to do. And he said to his teacher, "Why do I need to do this? I'm never going to use this." And I love the teacher's response. He said, "Because it's hard." And I was like, ah, like, and it clicked for him, like, oh, you grow and you expand and you learn when you do hard things. In the same way that learning takes effort. That's one of the things that Ethan Mollick shares in his article. And so it's, but I think it's hard when you're dealing with younger minds whose, brains aren't fully developed and we're often looking for that kind of, shortcut and to embrace the fact that, you're, the shortcut is short-lived, and when you're cheating in that way, you're cheating yourself. How can we encourage students to recognize that AI is not meant to give you the answer, but is to help you enhance your learning?
I think a big part of it is to help students realize that they can think so much bigger with AI than before. I mean, I think like using AI just to do homework is such a small win when you have a super intelligence in your pocket. And so what I recommend and what I'm seeing amazing educators do is basically tell students that this could be your co-founder for a startup that you can build much faster than you could have before. This is your thought partner for different types of research papers or like different types of personal projects you want to do. You can graduate from high school or college with a really strong portfolio that can help you land your dream job. And AI can help you discover that dream job, right? I think I agree a lot with like Sam Altman's perspective on this, which is that we're going to be a much more productive society and like the world's GDP is going to go up just because AI enables people to build so much faster.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I love the word discovery. I think the thing is that at whatever stage you are, if we all have that thirst for discovery, that's an AI can help us. I think about, the possibilities. What AI does is expand them. And so it's like whatever you can think of now, you can really find out about and create. And it's a really it's and it really opens up things if it's if you embrace it with the right mindset and approach.
Every year, I used to get like probably 1 year better at being a business person because of the exposure I would gain, like the types of projects I'd complete. But in the last year, I think I've jumped like 5 years just because I push back on AI often. I'm like, okay, so this is the strategy doc I wrote. Can you help me think bigger? Can you help me think like the CEO of a rocket ship company? Can you help me think like a Nobel laureate in the field? And just kind of going back and forth on those iterations, which improve my work product, but also help me think about the things that I don't know that I didn't know. And it helps me just become a better professional that way.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I like that because a lot of times in the training I do on AI, it's there's still a sense of like, well, you just ask it, it gives you an answer, and then you're done. And it's like, no, that's not how it works. Like, it's that iterative conversation between it. And so when you treat it like a partner or someone, I think that's really the, approach is the more human you treat it, the more it responds in kind. So if a lot has changed in over time and in the last 3 years for sure. But if you were to go back in time and talk to your kind of 21-year-old self and give that person some advice, what advice would you give yourself?
I think I put a lot of stress on myself in my early 20s to like basically have it all figured out. And I think, and maybe it's like just part of growing up, right? I think over time you realize that no one has it figured out and just to kind of calm down more. But I think like the advice that I give to a lot of 21-year-olds right now is to think about your career in a 40-year time horizon, because that takes away a lot of that early anxiety you have, because you may not have the perfect job at 21. You may not have it figured out which industry you want to be in. But looking at your career with a 40-year horizon gives you the freedom because you know that as long as you keep moving forward and iterating, like it's going to turn out to be a really interesting story. I think I encourage people to try to find that passion early because then you can commit to the sector, you can build a community around it, you can kind of continue solving problems in that discipline, whatever those problems, like the solutions will change, the problems are the things we want to marry. And so, but when you look again at a 40-year horizon, it removes a lot of the FOMO that you may feel in your early 20s.
I think I'm gonna have to share this clip with my two daughters because they're right in the midst of like feeling like they need to figure it all out, and not realizing that you got time,
Or
and I.
basically, so you're just training for like the ultimate jobs that you want, and as long as you're on the path, you'll end up somewhere great.
Oh, reminds it, the thing is, I'm like, whatever experience you have now is good because it's experience. You have none. You don't have any experience. So whatever experience you have now is going to help you. And I think it's also, I love the there's a quote, which is, even if you fall, flat on your face, you're still moving forward. And I think there's, I kind of like, fail fast and fail forward is something that I think, life's too short to get hung up. Like, just keep trying to figure it out. And surround yourself with people who can help you get there. And I guess, speaking of that, you've been amazing in terms of the fact that you've been at the cutting edge of a lot of things, whether it's online training, and now you're at kind of the cutting edge company. So by most, definitions, people would say, Sia, you're a success. But I'm always curious, how does Sia define success?
That's very kind of you. But how I define success, and like, I think there's some really good books about this, like, how will you measure your life, right? For me, it's very clearly about like the number of people who are able to pursue new opportunities and like break into like more financially rewarding careers. I think what like the emotions that really drive me towards the sector are like the frustration that people feel when they feel locked out of their career potential. That's kind of what I felt at 18. I'm like, if I don't become a computer engineer, I'm going to be locked out of my career potential. I'm going to end up in some small city with like not a great job, right? And so that fear, and it's something that a lot of people face, like across America, we're seeing that a lot right now. And so I think it's like the number of people that we can influence to move into new socioeconomic classes.
I love that. And I think, for me, what I hear is it's the impact. That's what you're doing. You're having the impact on people, and that's actually how you succeed. By I think it was Zig Ziglar, who was a kind of motivational speaker, said, the way you get what you want is to help others get what they want. Like something, and I think that pay it forward kind of, if you're putting yourself out there and helping others, then you're, A, that in itself is a reward. But it leads to good things. So I have, I have children and I have young people, students, but just and people who are new to AI still. It's moving fast, but it's still early for a lot of people. What if I'm like, I don't know anything about AI, I want to get started. Where should I start my AI literacy journey?
Honestly, AI is the best teacher of like how to use
Hmm.
it. What I'd actually recommend is most people just like start by opening chat.com and helping ask it to help improve an email that you're sending, help it make the email sound more executive or like less pushy or whatever your aspiration is for what your tone should be like. And I think that's like a very early win and use case that a lot of people just starting out with AI see. And the prompt I really like, which I think a lot of people get early value out of, is tell ChatGPT who you are and what you want to become. So basically, be as clear as you can. Like, copy paste your LinkedIn, share your resume, whatever it is, and be like, this is what I've accomplished so far. This is who I am. This is where I live. And this is who I want to become. Or if you don't know, be like, what do you think I can become? And have that conversation with it. You're going to be amazed by how like prescriptive and supportive of a timeline is going to provide you. For me, I shared my goals and it gave me an 18-month timeline of like the different types of projects I should do, the skills I should build, the people I should meet. And that's phenomenal because it's like it's a really good coach if you use it this way.
I love that. And I think, again, I'll get, because I'm kind of obsessed with AI, a lot of people come to me and say, how do I do this or how do that? I said, you ask ChatGPT, like you ask AI, they will tell you. And I think that people don't recognize that. Now, in terms of education, so I'm kind of curious, both in terms of K-12, but then also in terms of one of the challenges is how to teach the teachers. So in terms of because a lot of teachers are as new to AI as anyone else, and now they're being told, well, we have to teach our students how to use it. What do you think is the best way for an educator who's like, I want to be able to use this in my teaching to help others? What's the best advice you kind of give to start that process?
Yeah, the very first thing I want to say first is that educators bring so much lived experience and understanding of their classroom, and that's irreplaceable, right? Like, so AI is a tool that's me meant to help them, support them in however they want to deliver their education to their students. But their personality, their experiences are really what students remember and care about. And so, like, when I think back to my teachers, like, the reason I remember them is not for their lesson plans or the assignments, but for who they were and how they made me feel. And I think, like, I want every teacher to recognize that AI is supporting them and getting all of the other things done so they can focus on the mentorship, the coaching, and the interpersonal relationships that they form, which become pivotal for a student as they go through their life journey. So, with that said, for educators who want to get started on AI, we're building a bunch of different tools. We've created a couple of partnerships. We've created a lot of online content, helping educators start thinking about where does AI fit in, like, lesson planning and quiz grading, and like building custom like stories and assessments and projects within their classroom. So, I'd encourage them to check out OpenAI Academy, which is our free open library. We're building a lot of great K-12 content there, and also profiling the stories of K-12 educators who are doing incredible work so they can all learn from each other.
I love that. And it's, as a teacher, it's one of the things I'm like, how could I use this? AI moves really fast. And most people would say that usually whatever we're seeing as consumers is a little behind what's actually available and those kinds of things. So you're in the inside of, one of the, if not the biggest kind of AI lab space, what do you think is the next trend in AI that we're not thinking about? Like, what's coming that we're like, oh, that's going to be like, oh, I didn't see that coming.
I think that AI is just going to become more and more seamless over time and embedded in our lives. So the ability to converse in different modalities with AI, which will be huge for students with different kinds of learning needs, will be incredible. I think the ability to customize more as our memory for ChatGPT and others gets better, is powerful. Like it remembers who you are, what you want to do, and helps you perform better every day. I think that's really powerful. And then finally, like removing some of the friction to doing more advanced things with AI. So when AI like acts as an agent for you and actually goes and performs tasks, like Sarah Friar, CFO, talks about how fun it would be if it goes and does your taxes for you, right? No one likes taxes, and it'd be really nice if a smart AI agent can do that. So I think it's gonna help take out some of the friction in our day-to-day work and be more seamless to connect with on a personal level.
I was at a conference speaking, and I said, eventually you're gonna wake up and just start talking to AI like you know. It's, we have our phones in our pocket all the time, and I think it's become, we take it for granted that it's just there and it can do all these amazing things. I think AI, that seamlessness will shift where it's just a part of our everyday experience. And I think it'll, things, when we start things to get take for granted, that's when you don't even think about the power of them. And I think, it's coming faster than people realize. And it's for me super exciting and fascinating, as someone who sees tech and is like, I can't wait to, see what it can do. And I think, really thinking about how it can make life better, which is, I think, is the approach I would take. Okay, so CNLs are kind of rapid fire section, which I should call it something else because it's not always rapid. But and if there's a question that's, not quite there, don't feel the need to, have to come up with an answer, but see how we go. So I'm a movie fanatic. So can you name one of your favorite movies?
Iron Man 2. I love Robert Downey
Wow.
Jr. Could watch him all the time. And honestly, just like love his personality and Jarvis and everything
I
else.
was gonna say, it's Jarvis is probably who you know, and we're all gonna have a Jarvis one day. I can't wait. Can you
Hopefully
name
as
a book
sassy
that?
as Jarvis
I'm
too.
sorry.
Hopefully as sassy a Jar as Jarvis as well.
I gotta have someone who's got that kind of personality. Can you name a book that left a lasting impression on you?
Jeffrey Pfeffer's Seven Rules of Power is really good. It's based on his class at Stanford GSB, and it talks a lot about how you can build like the right types of communities and support structures, especially if you're working in the tech industry to advance your career. Highly recommend that.
We'll definitely have that in the show notes. All right, now this is a challenging one. I always, when I'm speaking to people who work at AI companies, whether I should tweak or not, but I'm gonna ask, I'll ask it this way. This is a little curveball, but so can you name a favorite AI tool that's not provided by
Oh
OpenAI? See, because obviously, you're gonna
no.
answer, one of the ones. So, do you use anything that's not created by OpenAI?
I'm very locked in right now, so it's mostly
Okay, so what's your favorite product that OpenAI currently has in the market?
lot of fun with Sora creating short form videos. I recently hosted a party and I did invitations with Sora and stuff like that. So that was fun. I like Imogen a lot. I create like fun anime images. So I think that's like what I'm most passionate about at the moment.
I love it. I think Sora's great. And the thing I think that is, from my perspective, advanced the most with OpenAI, I mean, it's done incredible stuff, but its image ability, generation took a huge leap in the last 6 months or whenever that moment was when you're like, wait, it can do make an action figure out of me. It was really remarkable to see. Can you name a favorite emoji?
Oh my gosh, yes. I love the monkey with the eyes covered emoji. I think that's so cute. I love the squid emoji. I use a lot of emojis with friends.
As a visual person, I think emojis are awesome. Please, can you name a favorite non-digital activity?
I love walking around New York City. It's just like you always run into someone or something amazing as you walk through. But I've not yet seen the big celebrities that people keep posting about on Instagram. So I've not yet run into Ryan Gosling.
Ryan, if you're out there, come and find see you.
Yeah.
What is the one thing you can't live without?
As far as a technology device,
You answer however you want. I mean, I had someone say air, I had another say coffee, so.
I think conversations, like I'm a very extroverted person, very important to me to get social time in with people. And after the pandemic, I think a lot of people stopped socializing in person, but I keep trying to bring people together. So we host a lot of like happy hours and events in New York to bring the education community together, for example.
Love that. And finally, if you could be credited with inventing something, either something that exists or something that doesn't exist, what would it be and why?
Definitely in the education space, I'm sure. I think right now I've been thinking a lot about like better coaching mechanisms. So probably something along those disciplines. But I think I want to capture probably the best sentiments of like the coaches that I've had in my life. And I think about like Professor Robert Metcalf, like a very influential professor for me in college. Like if I could have a way to converse with him all the time, that would be so incredible. He's of course way too cool. He's like hiking Patagonia and doing all these cool things now at MIT. But it would be fabulous to enable that for each individual so they can get the kind of support and knowledge from some of the best minds in a very personalized way.
I love that. You've been so generous with your time. Is there anything at the moment that you want to promote or share that's going on in your end?
I love hearing stories about how people are using AI in both education and the workforce. So, any interesting stories, I would love for people to share on LinkedIn.
And my next question was, if people want to find out more about you, what's the best way to connect with you? I'm going to assume now that it's LinkedIn.
Yes, I share a lot of the work that we're doing, the research we're seeing, as well as like how customers are using AI on LinkedIn. Would love to connect with people there.
Awesome. See, this has been amazing. I love what you're doing. I love your approach. And I really appreciate you sharing all these things with us. And most of all, I want to thank you for helping us connect the dots.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast sponsored by AIQ. Subscribe at AIQnewsletter.com. Music produced by Sam Miller. Please subscribe on your preferred podcast platform so you don't miss any future episodes. If you could do me a favor and please leave a review on iTunes, I would really appreciate it. Remember, story matters and is the best way connect the dots.